Namaste. Among the contemporary issues in relation to Sanatana Dharma, we take up today an issue which is ancient and modern at the same time. And it is about the construction of Ram Mandir, as it is called, in Ayodhya. So, before the whole thing was turned into a controversy and many kinds of suggestions were coming up from all sides, one of these suggestions was that let it become a symbol of harmony by, instead of a Ram temple or Babri Masjid, make some kind of a inter-religious place or an educational institution or a kind of Indic studies. Now all that is okay. They are ways of thinking and it's perfectly fine for each one. But what we need to understand is that why is it that Indian culture has survived so many onslaughts? So very often when this question, I mean this is a fact, because all other cultures have been overrun by either Christianity or Islam, and both came to India, tried their best by force, farce and lure and various kind of attractions. But in the process, both of them, to an extent, got Hinduized, if I may use the word. The way the festivals are celebrated here, and many of them, they developed many things which are more indigenous and Indic. So, what really is the strength? Normally, when we speak about it, we speak about the Vedas and the Upanishads. No doubt about it, Vedas are excellent in every way, but the problem is that Vedas themselves were lost for a long period, the Vedic lore. It was misunderstood, not only by people outside, but even within India. So while Vedas is a background, yes, and it's also true that there were a number of saints and sages and seers who realized the same truths and put them in their own language, local dialect, or for instance, the entire Sikh movement, if you see Ek Omkar, it starts with that, and Alak, then Satnam, all of them are straight from the Vedas, Vedic lore. So this way the fire of the Veda, the aspiration was kept alive. But for a common person to connect with high kind of mysticism is not an easy task. At the same time, in other religions and traditions, why they got broken was because there was a whole shell of rituals and ritualistic occult practices and ritual practices with which the modern wave could not connect. So we again see that got broken. I mean, to imagine gods and goddesses with animal kind, at the same time certain rituals like in Egypt, Rome, Greece, it was difficult to connect with the Greek gods, for example. It's very difficult to connect with them. You can believe them, disbelieve them, offer a prayer, etc., etc. But one reason why in India the culture survived and continues to survive is because one is the diversity that it created, tremendous diversity. So if you approach it from one side, there is another thing which will bring it up. So it was not related to one single set of practices or one kind of ritualistic behavior or one book or one founder, but many approaches. So it's very difficult to demolish a diverse culture which from many angles is approaching the one reality. But also because it tried to make a ground connect with people. So because ultimately that's how the people connect. They don't know about the Vedas and Upanishads. They know. I mean, I have grown up in a household of Vedas and Upanishads, but my connect was not really through the Vedas and Upanishads. Even the Gita was there and I had read it, but it didn't feel so intimate. But what felt intimate was Ramayana and the Mahabharata. It's something so amazing. So immediately you connect with the characters, they become contemporary, they become relevant, and it does something to you in very practical terms. And it places before you an ideal which is at one level very tangible. At the other level, it's something which you want to strive to, because you feel this is where you can reach. Vedic practices of waking up the fire and doing a fire ritual is not easy for most human beings either to understand or connect. This is not to say the Vedas are not great. They are, of course, among the greatest of scriptures in the world. But I am speaking of connecting. And the second reason why the culture survived was because it wove this entire spiritual life into the fabric of Indian society in every strand of it, from birth to death and death to birth. You see everywhere, somewhere or the other, spirituality in this way or that way, through this door or that door, through so many festivals. One of the things that people used to often say, that why in India we have so many festivals, and people used to make fun in school. But not realizing that this was one way that the entire life of India got woven in the strand of religious and spiritual thought. So in India, they always knew that this is religion, there is something greater than that. And yet it was running through the very fabric of Indian life. So many kinds of fasts, so many kinds of days. Every day had some kind of a astronomical, occult, spiritual, religious significance. So this is another part through which Indian life could continue without any kind of destruction. Because if you try to suppress one, there is another dimension which will open up. But most of all, as I said, through the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, I think the Indian culture was carried on, both through folklore and through countless translations, knowing that Valmiki Ramayana is not easy. It's in very good, high, pure and chaste Sanskrit. A very beautiful Sanskrit. To those who know about Sanskrit, very different from Vyas, whose style is very different. But still, Ramayana has been in so many languages. If I am not mistaken, almost over 200 different versions of the Ramayana exist. Of course, some of the most popular are Kamban in the southern parts and Ramcharitmanas in the northern parts. So this kept the flame of Sanatana Dharma alive. And as I said, this is something very tangible which they kept before man as goal. So they were different. As you evolved, goals continued to go further and further. So we see in the story of Dashavatar, and among them Ram and Krishna standards, two very interesting pillars or signposts of Sanatana Dharma. So where does Ram stand? Ram stands at the gateway between the animal and Rakshasic Kamasuric nature. So he humanized them. So Ram is a very tangible human. He is not human, he is of course the avatar, but he presents before us the ideal human being. This is something exemplary and I think extraordinary, because he is portrayed as somebody with an ideal filial love, ideal perfect obedience to parents, and whose love for parents is so unstinted. He is portrayed as an ideal husband. That last part we'll come to, as an ideal friend. And not only is an ideal friend, a human being, so a love and compassion for everyone, and yet is noble, courageous beyond measure, and full of confidence and faith. He is an ideal leader under whose banner people, even the Vanaras and Kishkindans, they wanted to fight with him. So Ram is portrayed as someone whom humanity can reach. Though he is kept a little far, it's not easy, and yet humanity can strive to be like Rama. So this was something so beautiful. So most human beings can easily connect with him, and that is the great significance of keeping the lore of Rama alive and Ayodhya Ram temple. Through all these symbols, India kept in the mind of the race, it preserved the ideal of a noble human being, what an ideal human being should be. So whenever we need to understand what should be an ideal human being, we don't think in terms of reason. In fact, rational life hardly gives any signs of an ideal human being. But if you see an ideal citizen, who is an ideal citizen? He acts according to reason and who follows all the laws and rules of the constitution, even if they jar with your own innate sense. But so that's hardly anything to look forward to. But when you look at the persona of Rama, you feel there is somebody who one has to look up to. At the same time, the other pillar is Krishna. When you have become a human being who is very sattvic, illumined mind, all courageous, always wanting to have a checklist of the right things, righteousness. He's a paragon of dharma, so to say. But there are times and moments when you are not sure how to really conduct your life, because the dharmas themselves, both sides, you can argue in this way, you can argue in that way. That's what we see in Arjun. So crisis of Arjun is another kind of an ideal sattvic human being in his own way. He lives by the edicts of the age. He's a noble, he's an Aryan, he's among those who are very skilled, he's courageous, he's all those qualities he has embodied in his own way. But all his ideals, he loves his brothers, he loves his grandparents, he loves his guru. In many ways, he is Rama who comes in another form, miniature. Of course, Ram is Ram, but still, Arjun is like that. Somebody whom a grandparent, a guru, a parent, a wife, they would all want to have somebody like Arjun. But Arjun is unable to resolve certain dilemmas which relate to dharma. Dharma, as we have said, is the core issue of Indian thought. And then we see Krishna. Now, Krishna is superhuman. Krishna is complex. Krishna is when we are human, but we can realize its own failings and limitations. So we see that there is Rama, there is Krishna. Krishna is superhuman, Rama is more human, and within humanity, his superhumanity glows in the background. In Shri Krishna's life, the superhuman is in the forefront, and the human self is largely fading into the background. And with Sri Aurobindo, we see that he sums up the human and the superhuman and takes it to another level altogether. So when we come to Rama and Rama's character, the way it is portrayed, he becomes a highest Aryan type to whom we all would want to become. That's why it's so important to preserve these ideals, because not all of us are ready for either for a purely rational religion and rational life can never find a complete acceptance in human consciousness, for the simple reason that we are not just mental beings. We have a heart, we have dynamic parts, and a purely rational life will end up drying the very springs of love and ananda from the heart. And it's never going to work out, whatever our belief may be. We'll end up fighting, because reason, analysis, at the end of the day, divides. You will take one ideological position, another ideological position. And therefore, we need a comprehensive picture of a person who has an ideal ethic. He reasons out. In Rama, we see the higher buddhi operating at every level. At the same time, he is a person who is emotionally not subdued, but he is emotional. Valmiki's Rama is, you know, his emotions flow so much in abundance, and all shades of emotions he undergoes. At the same time, his dynamic life parts are very strong and noble, and all these qualities. So it's so important to keep this in the memory of the race through Ramayana, through these significant landmarks. And I feel that Babur, the first invader from the Mughals who destroyed the Ram temple, it was an occult act, because Rama was the glory of India, and destruction of the temple was a symbol that now that glory is eclipsed. It literally went underground. And when that glory is eclipsed, there is a long period of time which we see Mughal invasions and the British invasion, where that glory is eclipsed. Ram cannot be removed or destroyed, but his glory is eclipsed. And then we see now today, with the revival of the Ram temple, it's coming up, we can see simultaneously a rise of India. So these are not just coincidences or insignificant events. And leaving aside the political connotations and overtones and undertones behind it, I see in the building of the Ram temple in Ayodhya a revival of the ancient glory of Bharatvarsh. And it's important, because humanity must have a very tangible ideal to hold on to. So with this little background, I just want to read today, because we have done talks on Ram and different aspects, and as I said, this question we have taken up about abandoning Sita. Well, for Ram, Raj Dharma was beyond everything else. He had come to establish an ideal king. He is an ideal son, he is an ideal brother, he is an ideal husband in every respect. But for him, he came to establish what an ideal king should be. That's why till today, when we speak about an ideal kingdom, we don't speak about Krishna Rajya. We speak about Ram Rajya. And it is said about Ram Rajya that Dahik, Daivik, Bhautik Tapa, Ram Raj Kahuni Vyapa. There was no suffering in that era. Ram took all the suffering upon himself. He silently suffered. But he ensured that all the subjects met with a fair and equal chance. So we see in Ram a beautiful combination of socialistic ideals, modern socialism. We see in Ram the beginnings of a worldwide love where all kinds of creatures he takes in his folds. Even the Rakshasa and the Asura, when they are repentant and they want to change their ways, he takes them. We see in Ram a king who goes beyond the boundaries, but not to create his own kingdom, but to liberate those people, establishes their Vibhishan, for example, or Sugriv in Kishkindha, and then comes back to his kingdom. He's not there to create a kind of hegemony as an empire. We see also in Ram the highest standards of public probity. So whatever applies to the common citizen must apply to Ram. Whatever the rules of the day are, he applies them to himself much more strictly and stringently. So in many ways, he's set those standards for king, Raj Dharma, which I think till today are unsurpassed. So there is a lot to learn from him. And as I said, why it is called as Ram Raj? Because for any ill in the kingdom in ancient times, this was a understanding which is based on something very true, profound and occult. That a king was responsible for whatever was happening in the kingdom. And we see the mother pointing this truth that when, you know, something happened in a group and the captain was there, captain meaning thereby the ashram physical education captain, she would hold the captain responsible for either ways, because the state of consciousness of the captain affects the group life. So in Rama's kingdom, whenever something happened, he would look within himself. It was he who had to change. And if he changed towards perfection, it helped the kingdom. Leaving aside the fact that it sets automatically for people. So to say it this way, that as they say, generosity or virtues begin from home. So he followed the way of top-down leadership, which is how it should be. Not that those who are below, they must be free from corruption while I'll continue and then I'll touch the top. His leadership is, Ram as an ideal leader, is a top-down leadership. He must be without blemishes. Then the rest, automatically his immediate ministers and so on and so forth, right down to the last person, would automatically, it'll trickle down from above below. So all these and many more about Ram, which we have discussed in different talks. But today I want to take up two little passages from Shurbindo's translation from Valmiki Ramayana, whom Shurbindo has highly appreciated. He has spoken of Valmiki, Vyas and Kalidas as the three masters of Indian literature. And he says that even if all the rest were gone and these three remained, they are enough to put India in the highest ranks of what India was and what India yet can be. So Valmiki, that's another subject, Valmiki and Vyas. But today we'll just take up two small little passages. And why this is very interesting? Because Shobindo takes up a passage from Valmiki's Ramayana, which is about Ayodhya. So now we see a lot of revival is taking place, you know, regarding Ayodhya. Not just the Ram temple, but Ayodhya is changing. But what was the Ayodhya of those times? How it is described? It also speaks about the richness and opulence of India. And it's important to remember it. Otherwise, we have developed this idea that either on one side, India is bhuke nange log, people who are stricken with poverty. On the other side, the ascetic ideal. But ascetics were there, but the general public, for the general Indian, the ideal was not asceticism, but a life based on dharma, even if it is rich and opulent life. So here is a description, and the chapter is titled An Aryan City. Kaushala named, a mighty country there was. So of course this is history. Ayutthaya was part of the larger kingdom called Kaushal. So Kaushaladhish, Kaushal Naresh, that's how it is named. And Ayutthaya literally means a country which could never be conquered. Ayutthaya, you can't fight with it. So Ayutthaya is that. And its ancient name was Saket. Kaushala named, a mighty country there was, swollen and glad. So it's not just rich, but a happy country where people were happy. Seated on the banks of the Saryu. So even in the ancient times it's described that it's on the banks of the Saryu. It abounded in wealth and grain. And there was the city Ayutthaya, famed throughout the triple world. So Ayutthaya was not just, even the gods kept a watch. My God, what a country. So see, earth became, that's why it almost, even the heavens, that's how the king of the highest heavens in those days, Indra, he looked upon Ayutthaya and said, oh my God, what these human beings have built. So it was famed throughout the triple world. All the not just citizens of the earth, but citizens of the vital worlds and the mental worlds, the gods, even the titans, they all appreciated and rejoiced and admired. And who had built this city? Built by Manu himself, Lord of men. So Manu, as we know, is the prototype human, if you may use the word, demi-human or demigod origin. So for each age of mankind, as long as man is there, there is a, the king is Manu, who dwells in the subtle worlds, and it is he who governs. It is he who inspires humanity. It is he who leads humanity and the march of civilization forward. So Manu in Hindi comes from man, and he's the thinker. But which way man's thoughts will go, it is the Manu who inspires it. For instance, there are 14 different ages of mankind. This is the seventh one. And for each one, the name of the Manu is different. So this is the age of Shraddha. So the name of Manu is Shraddha. So he will instill faith, because this is supposed to be Kali Yuga. And Kali Yuga, the power which operates is Shraddha, faith. So there is this description of Manu who has established Ayutthaya. 12 leagues was the beautiful, mighty city in its length. Now, 1 league is about maybe 5 kilometers or 3.5 miles, approximately. So if you take 5, then 5 12 is 60. So in length, it was roughly about 60 kilometers. So big city. 12 leagues was the beautiful, mighty city in its length, 3 in its breadth. So 3, 5 is a 15. So roughly about 15 kilometers by 60 kilometers. A huge place. Large and clear cut were its streets. Shubhendu is describing, Valmiki is describing, Shubhendu is describing. So those who believe that they were primitive people, there was a whole serial, Bharatik Khoj, where they, actually it was not a Khoj at all. It was almost like, you see, even some of these more modernist version, they saw Ram as a primitive person, hunter, who is going around, but they don't realize that India was very developed at a point of time. Then it went through an eclipse. That's a different story. I mean, even now, when you look at some of these temples which are being unearthed, it's unimaginable. And imagine when they were in full glory. So he's describing this city, and a vast, clear-cut high road adorned it that ever was sprinkled with water and strewn freely with flowers. So you can imagine, a road which the central road is taken care so well. That's how a city should be looked after, so that people who live there and when they come there, they should feel happy about it. So it was sprinkled with water. That means probably they were not tar roads, because tar is more modern invention. They were roads which were made of normal earthly soil, but it was well looked after. Then comes another description. Dasharath, increasing a mighty nation, peopled that city. So the king is Dasharath. And we know Dasharath belongs to the Ikshvaku clan, the clan which was most famous for holding or keeping its promise. So that's how Dasharath, he is mighty. We know he had fought for the Devasur Sangram, in which Kekeyi was his partner, who had saved him literally when he had once entered into a swoon, and hence the boon that he had given. Dasharath increasing a mighty nation, people that city, increasing a mighty nation. So he was constantly making it more and more prosperous, inwardly and outwardly. Like a king of the gods in his heavens. So this was the original, always this idea that not to go away to heaven, but to make earth a heaven. This was the ancient ideal. A town of arched gateways he made it. So there were several gates leading to different directions, like we have, you know, God of Pondicherry, you have those toll tax naka, but there are no toll taxes. Now you are entering Pondicherry. So there were those gates through which you could enter and move out. So there were arched gateways he made it, and wide were the spaces between its shops. So it was not a crowded place. So it was, everything was in abundance, distances, everything was taken care of. Full was it of all machines and implements, and inhabited by all kinds of craftsmen, and frequented by herald and bard. So it was a place where all kinds of craftsmen, artisans, poets, thinkers, they were welcomed. And that's how in ancient India we see that, it was not debate the way we understand. It was another kind of free speech. But they invited people who had risen to great heights, poets of fame, men who were great thinkers. They were called to the city, and then the kings would sit in an assembly and there would be an exchange of thought. It didn't mean that everybody in the streets starts speaking whatever he feels like. That was not the ideal. I mean, people can speak what they wish to, but this was the ideal. So we see bards visited it, heralds visited it, those who were coming from other countries. A city beautiful of unsurpassed splendors. Lofty were its bannered mansions. It was, see, the opulence and the richness. So mansions were not small little hutments or flats with, matchbox style high-rise buildings. No, they are mansions and with nice banners. Crowded was it with hundred slaying engines of war. So it was well in might. So that's why Ayodhya was known as Ajaya. Nobody could ever conquer it. So we have that description also. Military-wise, it was strong. Industry was strong. The king was both noble and courageous and wise. And there were heralds and bards, poets, craftsmen. Everybody was encouraged. And in all quarters of the city, there were theaters for women. So, talk about liberality. There were theaters for women, and there were gardens and mango groves. So this is something we must develop in India. See, he has given the ideal idea. We are talking about smart city. How about taking this as a replica? We can have a digitally connected city, but we need to have gardens. We need to have those lovely parks, mango groves, where people could go and feel fresh, because it releases beautiful positive energy. It's not just about being net connected. In fact, that's the least important. That's important, but it's not that the whole country should be linked. That's one dimension. But to have parks, to have gardens, all these things, the way the houses should be built, not chaotic buildings. So all this is described here. Crowded was it with hundreds slaying engines of war, and in all quarters of the city there were theatres for women, and there were gardens and mango groves, and the ramparts formed a girdle round its spacious might. So all around the city one could see the ramparts. Hard was it for the foe to enter, hard to assail. So this is why it was Ayodhya, because you just couldn't enter and assail that kingdom, well protected, well guarded. For difficult and deep was the city's moat. So the spaces, small little spaces. So ancient time these cities were either surrounded by those little ditches, sometimes filled with water, all kinds of things, so that people couldn't easily enter. The enemy couldn't just attack. And there were those gates which were very well guarded. Filled it was of horses and elephants, cows and camels and asses. Crowded with its tributary, kings arrived for sacrifice to the gods. So it was a place where yagna was carried on, and it was abundant in animal life also, and kings arrived from different places. As we know, Dashrath himself had conducted the sacrifice from which, out of which all the four children were born. Rich with merchants from many lands and glorious with palaces, built of precious stone, high piled like hills, and on the housetops, pleasure rooms like Indra's Amravati, Ayodhya seemed. No aspect of life was shunned. All aspects we see. There are those bards and thinkers who are coming, heralds. At the same time, there is the might, the military might. At the same time, there are, you know, pleasure groves and beautiful colonnades and gardens, theatres, art and craft, and business, industries. For everyone and everything, there was a place. So this is a brief description of Ayodhya. Like Indra's Amravati, Ayodhya seemed. So this is the India we must bring back. It's not enough just to speak about the glories and then end up with the ascetics. We still have this ascetic ideal too strong in our veins. And as long as India holds the ascetic as the highest symbol of spirituality, it will not rise the way it must rise. So this is important. It's a small description, and I think this can be a very good model, I hope, for the cities that would develop. I think this idea of new cities was wonderful, because it is said that most cities after some few hundred years become uninhabitable. Even the soil becomes uninhabitable. But the new city should not be built along the way the old cities were built, plus some, you know, digital connection. They should be built along these lines, wide, spacious, and it can be done if we really care for. And then there is another passage where Shobindo describes an incident in the Mahabharata from the wild forest. That's how the passage, the title is, and it is during the Aranyapar when they go into the forest. And Vaidehi is still with Rama and Sita, and they go to Atri Rishi's ashram, and from there when they are moving to another Rishi, so in the meantime they meet with a demon called Virad. So that's a very interesting story. Virad is a demon who has got boon from Brahma that he cannot be killed by any astra shastra. So Rama, how is he going to kill? So he takes up Janaki, Vaidehi, and starts moving away. And at that point of time, there is both brothers fight valiantly, but he cannot be killed by any astra shastra. So finally what Rama does, he creates a strategy. He understands that only Astra and Shastra cannot be killed, but he can be buried or he can be burned. So he cuts his hands, both the hands. So whether he is free, and he falls to the ground. And that is the time when Lakshman builds a big ditch, and in that this demon is the slain demon, not yet slain, but more or less handicapped demon is put in the ditch and it's covered. And then they move. And while in the passing he says that I was a Gandharva in the previous life. So in Indian narratives you will see always that there is a connectedness. So connectedness between the previous life and this one, and this life and the other one. We see it in many stories. People read them out of context, like Karna's story. There's a whole connectedness. Shri Krishna having many wives, even that is connected to Ramavatar. So there are many, many kinds of connectedness. So he says, I was a Gandharva who had done some mischief and he was cursed to become a demon, but who cannot be killed by any astra shastra. So it's very interesting that there are beings. Now this augur and demon, it's very, this burying or burning is very significant. So this augur, he was supposed to be eating human beings who cross that way. So there is in human beings also certain impulses which are like that. The augur has died, but something of him remains in human consciousness. So you can't just kill it with all your might and all your thinking and will. But what it can be done is either buried in the subconscious regions, you sit over it, or you can burn it in the fire of purification. So that's how I see this symbol of the story. But Shubhendra has not written the full thing. He has just written two passages. The second passage is about the initial interchange with Virat. So that's not what I'm going to read. I'm going to read the first passage, which is about when Ram enters the forest and meets one of the sages. There's a beautiful interchange. And that's something very interesting. Then, possessing his soul, look at how it describes. Rama entered the great forest. The forest Dandaka, with difficulty approachable by men. So Dandakaranya was the place where many of the sages, hermits retired because, you know, they wanted a secluded life. But a secluded life was always threatened by ogres and demons and wild beasts around. So look at how he describes possessing his soul. When you enter a space which is dark, dangerous, full of all kinds of things, so Rama makes sure that he is filled with his soul strength. And beheld a circle there of hermitages of ascetic men. They were ascetics. They were not the mainstream ideal. They were on the pale of society. A refuge for living things with ever well-swept courts and strewn with many forms of beasts and swarming with ceremonies of birds and holy high and temperate sages graced those homes. So sages used to come, sometimes the kings would come, often they would retire. Shubhendra describes in Savitri the king sages from their task and after the war. So they would not start advertising what they did, didn't do. They would retire to this forest because they've committed very high and violent deeds, maybe proud deeds, loud deeds. So they needed to enter into these places to recoup their soul. So after such deeds, they would come into these places. It should be, it's a way of Indian life. I don't know how it is in the Western world, but kings, presidents, not no more kings, but prime ministers, they visit these founts. And I think they should do it more often. Like at least for the ashram, I know that Abdul Kalam had come, Indira Gandhi had come. Indira Gandhi used to come and stay here for some time. Even within the ashram, there was a room for her. She has stayed overnight within the ashram. Now that doesn't mean that all the generations are blessed, but as far as she is concerned, she was an instrument and the mother used her as an instrument. Especially Bangladesh war. Nehru has come. Lal Bahadur Shastri has come. Atal Bihari Vajpayee has come. Atal Bihari Vajpayee, we know that when he met the mother, when all others had left in the delegation, he came back. And then he looked into the at the mother with folded hand that he wanted something. And the mother looks at him and asks, "What do you want?" He said, "I have this dream of Akhand Bharat, indivisible India, united India." So he wanted the mother's blessings. And then she went into a trance and blessed him. So just imagine a Prime Minister of India is coming there seeking such blessings. So many of these, of course, Prime Minister Modi has come, Amit Shah has come. So this is a typical Indian ethos. They're not going to church to please the church. This is part of the Indian ethos that the kings, the prime ministers, the commanders-in-chief, some of the commanders-in-chief of the army at that point of time, Bangladesh war, they came here, one of them settled in Noroville. So they know that ultimately the greatest power and wisdom is with these sages and seers. And they went there after their deeds to recoup their soul strength, peace, because they fought a war and it's not easy. So these were the people who came to grace their homes, those homes. The high of energy approached them, unstringing first his mighty bow. So when they came, so they didn't come with all the fanfare, not with, you know, Z security. These are all modern things. They came, they unstrung their bow. You can't enter with the weapons. You know how when Rama and Lakshmana came and Agastya Rishi's ashram, and they were asked by the disciples that you have to leave your bow and arrows here. So Lakshman, quick to answer, he says, but we are Kshatriyas and you know this is our defense. If we don't have this and there is suddenly an attack, so the disciple says, you don't have to worry about it. Rishi Agastya is sufficient unto himself. In his presence you don't have to worry. You are protected. This was the kind of strength that these rishis had. So they had to unstring their bow. See the details in which it's being described. And they beheld him like a rising moon, and with wonder in their looks, gazed at the fabric of his beauty. Whose beauty? Sages and seers. So the high of energy approached them. Them is the rishis. Unstringing first his mighty bow, and they beheld him like a rising moon, with wonder in their looks, gazed at the fabric of his beauty. Now this is about Ram and Sita. Now Ram and Sita and Lakshman have come. So they are being described. And they beheld him like a rising moon. Ram is being seen like a rising moon. And with wonder in their looks, gazed at the fabric of his beauty and its glory and softness. And garbed grace. See how beautifully he is described. And if you see Ram's description, we were just reading when Shobindu was asked that normally the vibhutis of the mother would be feminine characters. He says, no, even in the men, something of the divine mother's aspects are there. So which aspect was there prominent in Ram? It is Mahalakshmi. So you see his love, harmony, all this grace, charm, all that is there, beautifully Mahalakshmi aspect. And that's why perhaps he invoked Durga during the war. Some people ask that what was the relation between Ram and Durga? Mahalakshmi he had already. And of course, that time he needed that. He was strong. He is regarded as courageous beyond measure. But yet he invokes that Durga aspect so that his emotional heart doesn't melt when Rama, Ravana comes, or somebody comes and so invokes Durga before the war. So he is being described. And at Vaidehi too. Vaidehi is daughter of Videh, that is King Janak. He was called Videh because he was so much equal minded to the different touches of pleasure and pain to his body. So that's why he was a Jivan Mukt. And whether he too with unfailing eyelids they gazed and Lakshmana, for they were things of amazement to these dwellers in the woods who have come. Ram like a rising moon, whether he with unfailing eyelids. And with Ram, he is described. How Ram is described? He is described as fabric of his beauty and its glory and softness and garbed grace. This is how Ram is described here. Great natured sages occupied in doing good to all living things, they made him sit a guest in their leafy home, and burning with splendor of soul like living fires. Now sages were also, they looked like as if there was a fire burning with their eyes, through their eyes it could be seen. They offered him guest worship due and presented all things of auspice, full of high gladness in the act. Roots, flowers and fruits they gave. All the hermitage they laid at the feet of Ram, high-souled and learned in righteousness, said to him with outstretched upward palm. So they have something to tell to Rama. And he is shown once again, there is something added. He is righteous. Rama is regarded as a paragon of righteousness. So what do they tell him? For that he is the keeper of the virtue of all this folk, a refuge and a mighty fame, high worship and honor are the king's, and he holds the staff of justice and is reverend to all. So this is how a king should be. The staff of justice, without fear or favor. A king can't say that, no, I'll not render justice just because he's near and dear to me. Just look at the kind of high standards for a king that were given that time. Sometimes I feel that this democracy and with all that, the prime minister, president, we have come many notches down. We have come down to, you know, a king becomes the product of the least masses. But that was not how it was in ancient times. The ideal of king had its own beauty. Not that we can go back to kingship. That has gone, something else has to come. Okay. Of Indra's self, he is the fourth part and protects the people. It was his task to protect the people against all kinds of things. Whether it be war, terrorists, misery, all this was his Rakshasa, the Asura. This was his work. O seed of Raghu. And then he reminds him that you come from a great lineage. All this was important in those days. What should replace it? People often ask, since we have spoken about it. If not democracy, what should come? The king, instead of the king, the president, maybe presidential form of government. President should not be elected by all the masses. But he should be the highest body, not a titular body. Today we have placed him only as a person with all the powers, yet no power. But someone who has, whom only the chosen lot should be able to elect in every way, who has shown himself capable through his conduct, through his way of life. All this should be there in his life. Then only he should be placed, maybe two or three candidates, and then maybe the best in the country choose. That should be. And then he governs. And all the rest can follow democracy if one likes. But this is how at least the top man should be, not simply an elected member. And maybe he should not belong to any party, but somebody who joins all the parties. Parties can be there. Or maybe the party should, the party system that we practice, which breeds so much of, why do we need the party? Why not a president? And then each one stands together and, you know, I mean, if he's good, he's elected. Remove the party system and you have so many candidates whom the people elect, regardless of their parties. And then see how the country will function. Yes, you can have the same system that majority decide if you want to put it about certain issues. But all these are elected representatives who are not elected because of party, but because of the work they have done, because of their either professionalism or their nobility or their, you know, conduct. That's how it can be done. I mean, I don't know. These are just thoughts which probably we'll take up some other day, because time has come to change the system. So he speaks of him as O seed of Raghu. And we see that this is there in Indian psyche. This is something which is carried on till date. Even today, why do we have this lineage? It's there in Indian thought. Though its time is over. And no doubt, heredity carries the truth. But sometimes the truth which beyond a point has to, you know, there is nothing more important than your deeds and ultimately who you are inside. But this is there in Indian thought that the lineage is considered important, was considered important, still inbuilt within its fabric. Therefore he enjoys noble and beautiful pleasures, and to him men bow down. Thou shouldst protect us then, dwellers in thy dominion. So he says, your responsibility, he greets him, all good, blessings will go, but you should protect us. Thou shouldst protect us then, dwellers in thy dominions. For whether the city hold thee or the wilderness, still art thou the king and the master of the folk. So this is the logic that Ram gives when in the forest he slays many demons in Dandakaranya. From here the whole journey starts. And when people tell him, why are you doing it? He says, because I have come as an emissary of the king. And this is part of my dharma. Otherwise, why would you actually kill these people who have their own way of life? Thou shouldst protect us then, dwellers in thy dominions. But we, O king, have laid by the staff of offense. So it's not that they were not powerful, these rishis, but they have chosen to lead a life where they are not going to engage in these kind of violent deeds. Like Vishwamitra, Vasisht, he could bring out armed armies, armed men, and you know, from Kamadhenu. But they would rather not use that power for these purposes, unless it's really necessary. Because they are striving for something greater and higher. But we, O king, have laid by the staff of offense, we have put anger from us and desires of the senses. And in politics, you need these things. That's why when Shobhinda withdrew, he says, India is not ready for the kind of politics that I may give. And I don't want to engage in that kind of politics, because he had other things to do. So they have put forth anger and desires of the senses, and it is thou must protect us always. Ascetics, rich in austerity, but helpless as children in the womb. So this is what they tell Ram, that we are leading a life of like ascetics, we are far away. Even these ascetics, they have enough to take care of those who come as guests. But they say that we can't engage in, because the moment they engage in any kind of fight or war, there will be anger, there will be other things which will come up. They have left that life behind. So they say that though we have gained purity, though we have gained soul strength, but though we have gained moral strength, but what we do not have is the physical strength and the strength that would slay the demons and the Rakshasa and the Asura. So that's why Shobhinda speaks of the new age which is going to come, that we must have not only Brahma Tej but also Kshatra Tej. In ancient times, the two were segregated because that was the kind of ideal. Brahma Tej was with ascetics and seers. Kshatra Tej was with the Kshatriya rulers. They had another kind of Tej. They were also, in their own way, they were performing the sacrifices and growing in strength. But in the times that are going to come, one must have both Brahma Tej and Kshatra Tej. So this is Rama, many more things. So it's so important to get back to the subject. Somebody asked me, Rama is still worshipped in India. So my answer was, as long as man lives upon earth, Ram will be worshipped, revered, and held as an ideal for those who are still laboring under the harrow of the Pashu, the Vanara, the animal nature, and the Rakshasic and Asuric nature. Ram is for them still the benchmark and the standard. As long as kings are far from the ideal that ancient India had placed before us, Ram will still continue to be the beacon, the pallbearer of what a king or a ruler should be. So these are two things in which Ram is unparalleled. And of course, all this glory of Rama, even with regard to the family, the nation, of course he sacrifices family life for the sake of the nation. But yet, what really it means to love, to have love within a family, the way Ram loved, sacrificing himself. He is the eldest, but he is the one who sacrifices all the time to protect the brothers. And in every way he shows the perfect example of a perfect leader of humanity. So on this day of Ram Navami, we just thought we'll remember the truth of Rama. And of course, Rama himself, who continues to exist. Because once an avatar comes, he never really leaves the earth. And he continues to inspire mankind that yet needs him. And I must say, there are a large chunk of humanity which is not ready for Krishna, leave aside Sri Aurobindo, but yet needs Rama as their ideal.